One industrial building replaced the cash flow of 86 single-family rentals. That realization forced a much bigger question. Are we scaling the right way, or are we just adding complexity? And today we're going to take that question all the way into an asset class that most investors are actively running from. This Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast exists to help investors think more clearly about durable cash flow, downside risk, and how capital actually works after the acquisition. Today's guest, Saul Z, is a great example of what happens when you're willing to question the model instead of just optimizing it. Now, Saul started in residential real estate in the early 2000s. He sold nearly 2,000 homes through multiple cycles and eventually hit a breaking point that many investors never stopped to examine when one industrial building replaced the cash flow of 86 single-family rentals. Now, in this conversation, we're going to unpack, you know, what that moment revealed about scale versus complexity, why Saul shifted fully into small bay industrial, and how value creation happens after you own the asset, not just on the buy. And toward the end of the episode, we're going to step into an investment space that most investors are actively avoiding, and that's malls. We'll discuss when running toward complexity creates opportunity and when it can destroy capital. This episode isn't about chasing yield. It's about understanding the structure behind cash flow. Saul, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for having me here, for sure.
Yeah, man. I know there's quite a bit to unpack here today during this conversation. So excited to dive into it and get into the meat and potatoes. But I guess before we do, let's back it up a notch and set the groundwork. And for those that aren't familiar with you, that don't know about you, who you are, what you do, let's back it up before real estate and give us a little bit of the background story and ultimately how you found your way into the world. You've been doing that for, I think, 2+ decades. So, but you didn't start, I don't believe, in real estate as a, professional career as an adult. I mean, I think you had a little bit of a different path you had planned and then ultimately did find your way into commercial real estate at some point in time. So if you would give us that backstory.
I immigrated in the United States in 2000. I went to UIC, University of Illinois in Chicago. And my dream at that time, I wanted to be a trader or commodity trader. That was really exciting, based on vision what I had. But really 2001 in 9/11 and dot-com boom and everything went online, kind of another fizzled out, whatever it was in the 90s. And I had a friend who had a mortgage company here in Chicago. And while I was going to school, he shared about residential mortgages. And at the time, there was a residential mortgage boom. It was like early 2000s. And I got my appraisals license, which was during the accelerated course. So I was going to school and I was working as an associate appraiser for another appraiser. And I started doing appraisals. So that's pretty much was my first taste with the real estate. I think I was making like $250 a report, which is so much money at that time. Shortly after, I stumbled upon a course, how to buy properties in foreclosure auctions. And I bought my first condo for $86,000. And then I painted it myself. I did some work and I flipped it for, it was a profit of $10,000. When I made that money, I took an absence for 6 months from the college. I thought I'm going to come back. Pretty much the rest was the history. I started buying more and eventually I became a broker. I started brokering homes during the foreclosure crisis. I pretty much mostly did only foreclosure work for Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Bank of America, for big banks, probably sold close to 2,000 properties. And then when funds are started buying, I started doing acquisitions for funds, invitation homes, and so forth. And then in 2000, it was 2000, I would say, 12 run, 2012, 2015, I was buying for funds. And post 2015, I started flipping primarily. So I had a company, Illinois, ibuyillinois.com, before iBuy was the term. And we were buying, 100, 200 homes per year in three markets, in Miami, Chicago, and in Indiana. And then 2019, I bought my first commercial property. And pretty much, from 2020, I went full-time in commercial real estate. I sold all my housing and apartments, and pretty much started buying industrial properties from 2020.
Appreciate the background. It's funny you mentioned. I think you said iBuy Illinois was your name of the company or whatever. I owned iBuy Florida for many, many years.
Oh, you did?
Back in like 2002, back when I was buying a bunch of single family homes. I had a van wrapped with it, had billboards, iBuyFlorida.com. And that's funny. I let that domain expire many, many years back, and turned my focus to commercial real estate like you did, which was the better way. So obviously you had quite a number of years of experience in the residential side of things, buying for, big investment groups, and then doing deals on your own, doing lots of flips. You made a reference that you were able to replace the cash flow of 86 residential units. What wasn't working with your single family properties to where this one industrial property, exceeded the cash flow of those 86 individual properties? Was there something broken with the model? Is it just the model in general to where, residential real estate just doesn't really cash flow a lot individually? I mean, just help us better understand the economics there.
Yeah. And I definitely that was the post. And I think I presented that in Collective Genius. I remember when I did that analysis. I think it comes down to that. If you remember the housing, right? The housing, when we used to buy houses back, and it was like 1-to-1 ratio, it was normal to buy it, right? If you're buying the home for $200,000, you're expecting the rent for $2,000 or $450, $1,500. And then eventually it became not really true because the values were increasing, but the rents were not catching up, right? It was, so the margin always was going to be creeping lower and lower, starting, let's say, I think the best margins I saw, I think it was probably, in my career, like 2011, 12, 13, and then it started diminishing. At the same time, on the industrial side, I think, it actually did happen much, much later, way much, much later, So when I bought my first industrial property, I think it was 2019-ish, right? Now, we bought it for $9 a foot. Those prices do not exist right now. This industrial property right now here, it's probably $70, $80, $90 a foot that's what it cost. Yeah, the value, the rents doubled from where it was before. It was renting maybe like a $4 once we bought it. When it stabilized right now, we're getting at $9. But values also more than doubled right now. So at the time when I was buying that industrial property, I think it was what I called radioactive. The housing was really hot already. It was post, a financial crisis, and it was if you remember, 2009, I was a notion that housing never come back, and eventually came back, right? And it increased. No, in 2017, 18, 19, same thing was with industrial. Probably, I think very little people believe that it's gonna go back as it went. I remember once we stabilized that building, we bought it for $900,000, we put $250,000 into it. Within 8 months, we refinanced it and took all our bases out because I filled in that building, 100% full with four tenants. After that, we were still cash flowing $250,000 a year. So $250,000 a year, it was right around like you cash flowing probably in the house. After debt, after we cash it out, maybe $3,000 a year or so, maybe four. So it was the math, how much I'm cash flowing after debt compared to how much cash flow I'm getting for one building. And it was like, wow, it's almost 80 houses I need to cash flow in order to generate this $250,000. Plus with the 80 houses, you really want to have two property managers, it has to be like really solid areas. But if you're in a class B pushing to class C, definitely to. And this asset was managed by part-time property manager, So it was a real realization. Now, granted, this is not the case right now. I don't think so would be the case right now because, let's say if I would do it again, same property, I would not be able to buy it at these bases, and rents right now, the debt is higher. So it's not going to be equivalent to 80 homes because I think both values kind of peaked right now. It may be equivalent to maybe 40 to, between 20 and 40 homes, not 80. But that was my first experience when I did it. in 2019.
Yeah, no, I think you make a lot of good points there. I think there's a lot of other considerations as well, you know, and why I would argue that industrial or a variety of other commercial asset classes are just better and more efficient than that of, you know, 86 single family homes, right? 86 single family homes, you got 86 roofs, you got 86, maybe more, HVAC units, furnaces. You've got average tenancy of 1 year, and sometimes they turn every year, right? And so, like, you've got make ready, you've got downtime. You've got a lot of budgeting to do as it relates to, you know, future repairs, replacements of HVAC units, mechanicals, roofs, all that kind of stuff. Whereas, not that you don't have that to a certain degree with you'll call it an industrial property, but, and I don't know if what you were, the property that you were referencing there, if it was a triple net or, you know, some type of modified gross lease, I don't know. But at the end of the day, an industrial building is a little bit more basic in nature than that of a single family property. And so, and a lot of times, again, you know, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of times what you'll find is a lot of these deals are triple net, right? And so the tenants are actually responsible for pretty much everything, you know, tax, insurance, repairs, maintenance, upkeep. And it's just, it's a very clean, you know, cash flowing transactions. So, but I think, again, to your point, you know, the margins are quite a bit thinner today than maybe what they were back in 19. You know, it's funny looking back, I've owned some industrial property. I never really owned a lot of it, probably not even more than 10 years ago. It wasn't a sexy asset class. Like, it wasn't one that garnered the interest of big institutions, unless it was like a, you know, like the big distribution centers, like those always had institutional attraction to them. But when you're talking like, you know, a small, you know, small bay flex space and you know, smaller, you know, smaller multi-tenant industrial facilities and maybe secondary markets, like, that didn't have institutional interest. But today it's very different, right? Like, it's a different world today. It's kind of like mobile home parks that we're in 10 years ago, you know, institutions didn't, like, they snubbed their nose at it, right? They're like, ah, like, that's, you know, that's crap. We buy multifamily, we buy, you know, retail shopping centers, we buy, you know, trophy office towers. But now they're clamoring at it, just like they're clamoring at an industrial space, right? And not just in primary gateway markets, but also secondary and even tertiary markets. It, you know, has the demand for industrial mostly been in the demand, meaning from like from a tenancy base, but also even investor base, has most of this, you know, heightened demand, is it a function of e-commerce, the growth of e-commerce? Is that most of it, or are there other factors as well?
Yeah, I think here's my view on it. And actually, I want to make some corrections. It wasn't 2017. 2019 that where I stabilized the building, and I did the math, and we were literally cash flowing. But first building I bought was 2017. Actually, 2017 that was where I say the notion still was what I call radioactive towards industrial buildings. And I think at that time it was we, as a country, believe that no, still globalization and all the manufacturing is still going to be done in China and in Mexico. And I think that was going on. And e-commerce was kind of just getting started. And what happened right before the COVID, I think deglobalization notion came out into you know, ether, and we realized that actually it is going to be more and more supply chain is going to be coming back here. E-commerce was taking a lot of space. Institutional buyers noticed that. And really, let's say, talking about the small bay industrial, I've heard a really good analogy. It used to be that small bay industrial, those local credit tenants, they used to call them Section 8 of industrial. And right now they call it business parks for small, you know, apartment complexes for small businesses. That's how they call it right now. It's a little different connotation, right? But really, I think there's a couple of things. No, obviously, it was really, really resilient to e-commerce. Small bay industrial was not affected by e-commerce. Actually, it put pressure on it on more demand, because there is not every e-commerce person is selling right now through Amazon. We have a lot of e-commerce people who are actually storing products, don't have a front store, and they sell online. I have a beachwear, I have a granite, I have a kitchen cabinets, you know, people who are actually selling online pretty much, and they don't have a store like a showroom, so to speak. So that was putting a lot of demand over there. Also, when the COVID hit, we had retail, and and some of the other tenants know, small bay industrial was not 99%, but 100% of our tenant base. When looked, they were essential businesses, and it did not have to shut down. So actually, it was there was more demand into this, and that's why, you know, institutional buyers, they saw this trend, and actually the rents started going significantly up, you know, between, call it 18, 19, all the way till 22. And 22, when I saw those rents kind of, you know, I wouldn't say stagnated, but normalized in terms of growth. But really, you know, I see, let's say, pre-COVID and 18, 19, you know, the rents were probably, you know, $4, $5, $6. Right now, that's 8, 9, and 12, pretty much doubled within a span of 3 to 4 years. And after 22, they are still increasing, but maybe they're in line with inflation, you know, 5, 6, 7%, so to speak. And right now, they're normalizing.
Is there any markets in the country that you're aware of that have an oversupply of this type of product, the small bay industrial? And the reason I asked that question, I don't know the answer to that of where we're at today, but I do recall there was a period here in Florida prior to 08 where, you know, we called it flex space here, which I think it's a similar product, where there's like a small office on the front side and then a warehouse on the mm-hmm. on the back side of the building. And we had a period of somewhat of a boom down here. I remember I don't know if it was probably all throughout the major markets in Florida, but I was in the Tampa Bay area, to where after the market crashed in 08, one of the product types, in addition to single family homes, one of the product types that had an excess supply that took a couple of years to get absorbed, low price per foot or high cap rates, right? Like just, mm-hmm. you could get that quite a value with small bay industrial or flex space, because it was getting built like gangbusters down here for a period of time. Do you see that, being that it's like now it's kind of it's the bell of the ball, like, you know, lots of investors are very keen on it. Do you see there being a period of time, or maybe already exist, to where certain markets might have an oversupply? Is there a risk there?
I would say there are a few markets that I've saw that I've seen. It's I think one of the markets, it's Texas, and some part of Texas, because it's so easy to build in Texas in terms of permitting, and there's so much land over there. I've seen over there. But it's really not happening in the major metropolitan areas, because major metropolitan areas, typically that will be infill development. So what we buy existing, typically, facilities. We don't build anything. We have one parcel we're thinking might be going to be building in Ohio. But in major metropolitan areas, typically that's not happening. And mostly in major metropolitan areas, the construction costs are so high that it's not still economically feasible even to build in the area. So, for example, even if you're going to get, let's say I'm in Chicagoland, a lot of times, even if you're going to get a land that really inexpensively, and you can build, call it, if you call it tilted concrete, you know, in the major metropolitan areas, you can't really build metal. Tilted concrete is going to be $120-$130 a foot, just a shell with mechanicals, without office build out. So you really have to be in the markets where there is $12-$13 triple net rents, you know, and not a lot of market. I know many of the Florida markets are there, but many markets are not there. So it's really prohibitive even to build, you know. And those small bay industrial tenants there, they're similar to you know, in a sense, a self-storage type of tenant, because they have to be close by where they live. They're not going to go 30 miles away. And a lot of times they're servicing, you know, some other big industry. You know, a lot of times they're a service industry to something else. Yeah, so it's very locally confined. So we typically buy in assets that are existing assets. They just need renovation, and they need changed those rents to gross to net rents. That's typical play for us.
So I want to better understand what your buy box looks like today on the industrial side. So when an industrial deal comes across your desk, what has to be true before you'll even spend time underwriting it? Like, what are the key aspects that you're initially looking for to, you know, either filter it in to say, we need to spend more time, or this is going in the garbage can, doesn't fit?
Yeah, so as soon as it comes in, obviously demographics and density is the first key. So normally, you know, we would like it would be at least $65,000 in incomes within 3-5 mile radius. In terms of density, within 1 mile, 10,000 people, within 3 miles, 30,000 people, within 5 miles, 50,000 people. That's a minimum, of course, the more the better. And we want to see that the rents would be at least $8, triple net. If it's still low rent, it's very hard to push, then the value in terms of IRR. So you have to be in the market where rent's a little higher. Those things, and also clear height. So clear height, really 14 clear height or more. Occasionally, we can make an exception to go to 12-foot clear height, but it has to be really, really, really dense area in order to kind of justify it. Ideally, we want to be, you know, 16, 18 and more, you know, but 14 kind of the minimum clear height. In terms of size, rarely we can go below 30,000 square feet unless it's in the area where we can just bolt on into the another closed facility. So those are, you know, the initial underwriting guidelines, and then they go in and see how can we increase that value to 10 cap basis within, you know, 2-3 years, you know. So pretty much, you know, we can go in, you know, and 5 and 6 and 7 cap and lower cap, and we can buy even vacant building. But we need to be with our cost basis with renovation. Let's say, you know, we buy something for $80 a foot, and if we're putting $10 a foot, you know, we're $10 into all in. It means that, you know, within, call it 24 months, I need to make sure that those rents will be at least at $10 triple net.
You guys do a lot of work in and around Chicagoland area. Obviously, there are lots of industrial property in certain areas, submarkets of Chicago. Some stuff that's really old, right? That was built, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. Is it quite common that some that is like the stuff that doesn't meet your ceiling height criteria? Is it mostly older vintage product just because that wasn't necessary back then, or that wasn't a thing? Or like what's the determining factor of why one building might have a very low clearance while another one's going to have that 12, 14 plus feet of clearance?
Yeah, that's typically vintage. You know, typically older buildings they're going to be with a low clear height. And of course, yeah, ideally, you know, we want to be, you know, 1980 or later. But we have buildings that we bought, older ones, you know, almost like beginning of the century. But that becomes like a really, really heavy rehab, meaning you just gutting all in, like you're taking all the systems out and putting all in. So, you know, I mean, we bought buildings at $20 a foot and spent $40 a foot to make it happen, you know. So, but coming back to clear height, is really most of the time is vintage. It's not like, you know, old buildings are only, you know, we have we bought a manufacturing plant in Cleveland, Ohio. Those are almost like 30-foot clear height. But really most of the time it is the older buildings, and the only way to in create demand in those areas, either you have really, really densely populated, like an urban area, not even a suburban, but like urban area, or just cut it up, the building in a smaller units. In a smaller units, which you're making hallways, you may be subdividing building in half, and you're making a lot of exits and entrances from around the building. So it becomes more complex. You know, but again, we had really great successes in the past, but it comes down to that once you're chopping that off in a smaller units to make it functional, it becomes most of the time very, very, very heavy lift. Now, another way to do it, I haven't done it, but I've seen a couple developers do it here, simply just raising the roof, you know, meaning they just cut it from the columns, raise the roof and install new columns and do new skirting around it. It depends on the size, but it goes between $10 to $20 a foot for that exercise. You're typically saving the roof and saving the mechanicals. You need to obviously address, you know, extend the electrical, but you can save the lighting and the HVAC in the roof. That's between $20, $30 a foot, depending on the size. On a scale, you probably can go even and maybe $10, $15 a foot. for raising, call it 20 feet.
Interesting. No, and that makes sense. I mean, that you'd be able to do that. So have you guys ever considered projects to where that's part of the value add is actually raising the roof?
Yeah, we went to the bidding process, and one deal was here in Gournay, Illinois, about 300,000 square feet. We were going to pull a trigger on it, but at the last minute, we realized that, you know, if we're going to do 100 small bay industrial units in Lake County, if it was not enough demand, and we're considering to do that in Beaver Creek, Ohio. Also, we kind of went through a bidding process, but then it did not work there. Is just if the market is at lower rents compared to the nation, let's say if the rents are $6, if you're spending $3 in raising the roof, you're going to be, you know, you'll need to charge the $9, and $9 may not support, even though if it's going to be clear height that much. So probably it's feasible that if the market is like $10, $15 a foot, and just adding $30 in CapEx. So it means you need to increase $3 a foot. But if you're going from 10 to 13, it's manageable for the tenant. But if you're going from 5 to 9, it's not manageable anymore, in terms of, you know, how much they can pay.
I want to circle back to the first couple industrial deals you did. I mean, like, you know, there's a period of our time when we're getting into a particular asset class. You learn as you go, right? You build the plane as you fly it. You work out the kinks. You figure out the nuance of the business model, and you do better the second one, the third one, the fourth one, the fifth one, what have you. You improve over time. What are some of the bigger mistakes you made earlier on that you see is fairly consistent with new folks that are getting into the industrial space? Like, you know, everyone sees like the shiny object. They're like, oh man, Saul, he's killing it in industrial. I'm going to go out and buy myself a 50,000 square foot or 100,000 square foot industrial center. What are some of the big mistakes you made early on that you see other folks make as they're entering into the sector?
When you think about price per pound, right? No, the cheaper I can get, and it kind of ignore the location, ignore clear height, ignore something else, right? And you're going to make it up. It works when you're doing one building, two building, but this is not scalable model where you can pretty much, you know, don't pay enough to professional GCs, and when you're trying to do it yourself. So I guess the lesson is that don't overlook fundamentals, which is location and condition of the building. Don't be blinded that there's a reason why it's selling $10 a foot. You know, there's a deal right now, Rockford, $10 a foot, but there's a reason. There's location to that. And no matter how much cheap you're going to buy it, you're not going to make it work. And this, because the deal will be worth only someone is going to pay you rent. If no one's paying rent for it, no, it's worth nothing. So that's number one, you know, really, you know. And then eventually down the road, you can try, you justify that there is a reason why you should pay more for certain locations, certain condition, and certain demographics. And that actually has to take precedence instead of chasing as cheaper pound as possible. I think that's the number one lesson. Yeah.
No, I think that's you make a really interesting point. It's I think, again, to your point, I think that's common for new folks getting into any investment type, whether it's industrial, or, you know, mobile home parks or apartments, or, you know, I can think back to a number of occasions where someone might've brought me a deal. You know, they'll go on LoopNet, they'll do the filter search by cap rates, and they'll search, like, you know, things are selling for 10 to 20 caps, right? And then they'll, you know, literally properties in the middle of like nowhere, you know, really bad markets. You know, there's a reason why they're selling that. Number one, the financials are probably inaccurate. Number two, if it really is a true 20 cap, why? You know, like it's not a very desirable area. There's probably not, you know, if it's a mobile home park, there's not probably not a big demand for affordable housing. Like, for example, there's deals that all the time still get sent to me. You know, I know there's probably some decent neighborhoods in Flint, Michigan, but Flint, Michigan as a whole, it's just really, it hasn't been, it's not great for a litany of reasons. And you can still buy, to this day, you can go buy large, what used to be probably industrial or institutional quality parks. You know, they're 400 sites, but they're only 30% occupied, you know, and so you can buy them for probably you know, 14, 15 caps in place. And then, you know, the whole selling point is like, well, there's all these vacant lots. All you got to do is go buy homes and bring them in and fill them up. But little do you know is that the crime rate is literally off the roof for that area. The school districts are horrible. There's really not a lot of jobs in the immediate Flint area, you know, decent paying jobs. And so, like, how are you going to attract people there? Like, how are you going to fill it in with a quality resident base? Like, I get it. There's upside. How are you going to achieve it? If it was achievable, someone else probably would have done it. I'm not going to always say that's the case. But if you see these things floating around, they seem too good to be true. They probably are. Probably to your point, the Rockford property. I don't know anything about it. But, you know, if you could buy it for $10 a foot, and if it was actually a really screaming deal, it would have flown off the shelf. In fact, it would have never come to market at $10 a foot. It would have traded before coming to market.
Yeah, no, so on that point, I just want to probably the secondary things. Where I remember I was skipping through the demographics, meaning I would just drive by. I wouldn't study data exactly what the demographics are. And especially if you're doing longer project, a heavier lift, and if you're banking that, you know, how this facility will lease in, you know, second or third year after you know it's in your hands, one of the most important things I always look right now at growth of population. If the growth of the population is negative, you know, I mean, it's, you have to time it. It has to be, you know, deep enough so you can get in and get out. But it's not a long term, you know. And of course, my demographics right now, 65,000 in incomes and more. And of course, everyone has different ratios. But my point is, you should have to have a constitution or a buy box, because then the different asset will perform very similarly in the same demographics. You know, if it's not necessarily how cheap you buy, but know what dems are and what location and pattern, traffic patterns and population growth patterns, that asset will compare a very, very similar. Oh, another thing, which I learned also quite a few times, you know, hard way, and is just, industrial, especially self-storage, competition on oversupply. And oversupply creeps in very quickly. It's probably you don't experience that in mobile home parks because they're all out to build more. But in industrial, in self-storage, this is a real thing, meaning your value can go down like 50% within a year if you have some couple developments going on. I mean, it's, you know, you'll ride the way, but it may take another 5 years to absorb it, right? No, so this is also a real thing, which I was not aware of, because we don't have this in housing typically, unless it's a macro level, yeah. You know? So,
yeah. So how do you mitigate that risk? If you guys are looking at buying an existing property, do you take a deep dive and find out what permits are on the table for, you know, new potential industrial developments down the road? I mean, and maybe they're not even in the formal process yet, but, you know, is there additional land, that's, you know, maybe it's for sale or not for sale at the present time, but could be for sale, that someone's going to come along and build another facility or two or three and, you know, cause problems for you guys?
Yeah, I think, you know, so in the markets where you kind of have taps through just being there and through the brokers, if you're trying to buy in a new market, the first, you know, I can give you the process how I do it, really, the like 1-2-3-step process. If it's a new market, obviously CoStar, you know, looking at the vacancy ratios and how much vacancy, how much supply is right now presently. Then typically I pull, which I did yesterday, I pull comps within 3 years of similar assets. And usually I would like to have at least 30, ideally 100. And then I do a leaderboard on those comps. I use Manus AI, you know, they do leaderboard, and it gives me all the brokers who are moving this market. And it's pretty much just picking up the phone, you know, not something fancy stuff, just picking up and going through the list, asking for their time to meet for a coffee or to spend 5 minutes and start talking, you know, and promising maybe a listing later or just doing the diligence there. So that's that. Then after this step process, then we do secret shopping. It's either me or someone on my team is simply just calling other areas, you know, on active listings, if it's not the same brokers, maybe a property manager, just kind of, you know, checking out the vibe, the feeling, how much vacancy is there, right? Just from the conversations that you can get, know if they really throwing you a bunch of TIs or it's it's pretty much on their terms to get an appointment. So you get a feeling in terms of occupancy. And then last step is obviously looking at the county, how much permits we have, and, you know, talking to, I have always a rule, always to talk to three people in the county. If it's a smaller county, it's usually fire chief, development, and code enforcer. I want to talk to those three guys and gals personally, and through those conversations to get an idea, you know, exactly how much demand we have and what's waiting for me when I'm going to become a resident of this county.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. Well, good stuff, Saul. And I want to be respectful of your time, but and I know we're nearing the end here, but I want to switch gears for a moment, and I want to hit on a topic that that I think is unique probably for most listeners that are tuning in, and that's malls. I'd say probably for the last decade plus, headlines have read that basically, maybe even more than that, maybe longer than that, that basically malls have been dying, right? Back when we were kids, the malls were the cool place to be. I mean, I remember, you know, my parents dropping us off when I was like in junior high, I'd be dropping my friends and I off at the mall. We'd hang out there on the weekend. Like, that was the cool place. That was the happening place. And it's changed, shopping habits have changed for folks. I mean, obviously, back then you couldn't buy anything you need on Amazon and have it at your front door literally in 24 hours. So the world's a different place. And so a lot of malls have suffered a great deal for a variety of reasons. But, you know, surely consumer habits have really fueled the decline of a lot of malls in different areas. And so a lot of folks, I know a lot of investors have, you know, I'd say been running away from dying malls, but you've been running towards them. At least there's a couple different projects that you've found great success in over the last couple of years. So maybe speak to that side of your business a little bit. You know, what is the, compelling factor of the couple of mall projects you're involved in? What attracted you to them? And then what has that revitalization plan, what's it consisted of?
So we bought two malls. First one we bought in Piqua, Ohio in 2021, I want to say. It's been 2021. And it was right after a very successful project in Milwaukee. When we bought a block in Milwaukee, we bought 165,000 square feet, two buildings, former bowling alley, and we kind of chopped it off into small units. And that's where the industrial had so much demand, more than right now. And we just leased it so quickly. And we're like, well, let's go after those big boxes. You know, it really, the model works. We just need to figure out how we deal with zoning. And the one opportunity came in was Piqua, Ohio, 500,000 square feet mall, almost 60 acres lot, right? It's right on a highway. And it's almost, you know, pretty much close to being dark. Only a few tenants over there, and we bought it practically at land value, you know, like less than $10 a foot.
And the cost to maintain it, just, you know, the ownership, the cost to maintain it is excessive, right? I mean, when it's dark like that, like, it's, the carrying costs are very high.
It's probably, yeah, you know, let's say, you know, $500,000, even $2 a foot, so that's $1 million a year probably to keep up, keep that property, right? So we bought it. We were very lucky with Piqua, because Piqua was really welcoming any type of development. And we showed what we've done in Milwaukee, and we took, call it 2/3 of the mall, which was Alderman Box and Sears Box. And we, demoed inside, and we made beautiful Class B Amazon type of, you know, if you look at inside, if I can share some pictures, you know, really nice industrial facility. I would have called it a small bay. It's a mid bay, and where the boxes were between 10 and 20,000 square feet, and we filled it within 6 months, right? So that was completed. Obviously, you don't want to shut down an entire mall, because it's still around the residential area, and no city, I do believe, unless it's, maybe it's Flint, Michigan. I don't want to talk about Michigan, but if it's not, if its community is still vibrant, right? No one's going to let you to do it, just industrial side. So we left in the front retail and entertainment. So we put Trampoline Park, actually, Hero Day. Hey, Brad. This was the first tenant. Within I post ads myself, and I talked to the owner myself. So we put the first Trampoline Park in the front of the mall. Then we signed up a Mexican restaurant. And then we revamped entire food court. So we put another 8 food court operators inside, and we opened up an arcade, which we're operating ourselves, and a bar inside, also really nice bar. And that activated the mall itself. We still have probably 80% of the vacancy within interior in the mall. But side of the mall, which is Sears, is 100% full. Elder Beer is full. The front is full. We have some interior, some vacant. We were not 100% sure initially with the vision how we're going to go. We knew we're going to do first 2 boxes to go industrial, because that's going to carry our debt right away, right? Worst comes to worst, we can just cut it up this mall in multiple pins and sell those 2 boxes, called an 8 cap in it. And we're literally almost, you know, on our basis, right? So it was like a safety. Okay, we do 2 boxes first, industrial, that's safe. And let's see how it goes, how the tenancy picks up, you know, in other areas. So we did not have to go all the way industrial. So we're able to save retail in the front. Obviously, you know, probably that's another, I don't have numbers, but another $5+ million later in CapEx. And and right now 80% full. So when next play is, we have really good partner in that market, the Bruns Construction. Shout out Randy and Jim to you. So next thing right now, we submitting plans for 140 residential units. And once we will do that, this is going to activate even more traffic to the mall. So that's how we're going to revitalize.
Will that be a conversion? The residential units, real quick, would that be an existing part of the mall that you'll convert to residential, or it'll be an out parcel?
No, that's going to be on a parking lot.
Okay.
Because right now, when you have every single mall sits in America between 1,500 acres. If you look from the map, they are in the best possible spots, actually, right? But we're confined with the zoning and cities don't want to do any. But in terms of location, they're beautiful locations, all malls, right? So just ingenuity, how you approach it. But to answer your question, no, we're going to put residential units in the parking lot next to the – it's not going to look like a parking lot. It's adjacent to the retail section, which will be in a great addition to the retail section. So that's how we're going to revitalize it. So right now we're cash flow positive. We're still 80% vacant. We still have a lot of land. In terms of project, that's really a rewarding project. You're being, you know, praised by the city. People are very thankful what you do. It's at the same time, you are pioneer, right? No banks don't believe you. It's hard to raise money. You have to have supportive city who's... In Pickwa, we had to rewrite entire code, and Chris, no, thank you very much. You know, he's a planning director in Miami County, and he was just a blessing for us. And we had to rewrite entire code in entire county, because the special use we couldn't figure out how to do it with existing code. So there's a lot of moving parts. It's really, really exciting projects. At the same time, we're planning for to completion this project maybe like between 2 and 3 years, like other projects. But it seems like it's going to be probably 5-year horizon, 6-year horizon, you know. So are you buying it? You're buying them at very, very low basis. So it's really hard to lose them if you go and do massive construction and execution, right? But it's very challenging on debt, very challenging on capital.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you know, your capital stack there, and maybe to speak to the equity piece of it. How difficult was it, you sharing your vision wasn't absolutely clear from the get-go, right? Like, it kind of evolved over time, but did you find it to be quite the mountain to climb to express not just your vision, but get buy-in from investors? I mean, because again, you know, to the point I made, I think earlier, is that, you know, I think the general consensus was that malls are dead, right? They're dark, they're dead, and you know, they're in the graveyard already, right? And so, like, you basically flipping that on its ear. How'd that go? I mean,
first one pretty much was almost no outside investors, and it was between 3 of us personal guaranteeing, chipping in down payment, and we have a small slug of mezzanine debt, which was collateralized with all other assets, because we did not have enough. I mean, we could not even. I mean, the math was very. It seems like this property is going to double in value. There is. I mean, these these massive assets used to trade like in '90s, $50 to $100 million, you know, 400,000 or 500,000 square feet, right? So if we're going in, if we're gonna spend all in $10-$12 million, just like a base on rough number, should be worth between 20 and 25. We did not know how many years it's gonna take exactly. So with the first one, we kind of rolled the chips with our own balance sheets and our own down payment. And once we have, you know, the performance, you know, the second one, we thought we're gonna start raising money. So I can touch a little bit on the second one if you don't mind. That's an interesting story. So we had to pivot the vision on the second one, Ontario Mall. We're gonna go the same way. We're gonna do Macy's box industrial, and this is gonna be our safe thing, right? When we do the first boxes, we refinance it. We take more debt out. We roll to the second phase of the project. When Ontario came in, we got an offer from Rural King. They just closed like a 3 weeks ago for $2.7 million that Macy's box, and entire mall bought it for 4.7. Even though we made less money, for example, from Rural King, but they're gonna bring $4 to $5 million additional. Into the mall, because we know how their store is looking. So we made the choice, actually pivoting from industrial play. We are selling to Rural King because they're going to bring traffic. They're going to invest another $4 to $5 million, and we completely pivoted. So if we would do, let's say, regular syndication, right, that would be really hard to pivot. But then there was like, you know, only three people in decision making, and there's no board of directors. It was very easy to pivot and sell to Rural King. It's 180 degrees pivot to a different direction, but I know it's going to work better for community, for the mall, for everyone involved eventually.
Yeah, no, I mean, just the foot traffic alone that they're going to bring that you would not have otherwise achieved with just a normal industrial tenant, right? Rural King, is that the same as Tractor, similar to Tractor Supply, or is it a group?
Like, similar to Tractor Supply, okay. Yeah. You know, that's, it's family-owned business, you know, a really tight company. They're here a lot in the Midwest. I don't know if they have in Florida, but a lot of them in the Midwest, they're expanding rapidly.
Well, that's exciting, my friend. Again, I think there's something to be said about doing well financially by doing good socially, right? Like, actually, you're having a major positive impact on these areas that have, you know, basically been going the opposite direction for many, many years. You're getting the support of the local municipalities. You're just doing a lot of great things. I mean, even just for the residents that live in the immediate area, right? Like, you're now providing them amenities that probably... When the mall went away, a lot of those amenities went away of these small towns, right? A lot of the towns revolved around these malls. Like, as I said, where I grew up in a smaller town, and the mall was the thing. We had two malls. The one was the one you didn't really go to. It was kind of the, you know, wrong side of the tracks. But, like, you know, the better of the two malls had the arcade, it had the movie theater, you know, it had a couple of the big boxes, and that's where everyone hung out. I mean, that was like the center hub of our town growing up. And so, glad to see that you're bringing that back. That's awesome. Love everything that you're doing, my friend. For those that want to learn a little bit more, you know, what you're working on or connect with you, I know you've got you put out a blog. I don't know how often you do it, but it's a great read every time it comes out. I know you got a blog that you actively do. Where's the best place for them to find you and learn more about everything you got going on?
Yeah, the best place is probably connect with me via my newsletter. Just go on joinvaluebuilder.com, joinvaluebuilder.com. I write weekly. It comes out 9:07 a.m. Central Time every single week. I write mostly about case studies of our deals and how we do them, and some other reflections of my commercial real estate journey. And we have 10,000 readers right now already. And if you write me, I'll reply to every. If you reply a comment, I pretty much take the time and reply to each of you guys.
That's awesome. Well, I love it, my friend. Well, again, appreciate you coming on the show and just bring a, you know, lots of additional insight. You know, talking about not just all the wins that you've had, but, you know, some of the challenges you've had along the way as well. We I think we've learned a lot during our time together. So. Let's stay connected. I'm wishing you all the best here in 2026, my friend. Keep doing big things, and we'll chat soon.